Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org, coming to you from Bushwick, New York, in the shipping container at Roberta's. And I'm just extremely excited today because we have not the entire Mondavi family, but three members of the Mondavi family here. As I'm sure you guys know, Mondavis are just absolute icons in American wine. Have spread the word about what great quality California wine can be like, and has really, I think, done quite a bit for the world. I really can't sum it all up in just a short little quip. But welcome Mondavis. We have Michael Mondavi here sitting to my right. And then his two kids, Robert Mondavi Jr. and Dina Mondavi. So welcome, everybody.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I'm looking at a lineup of wines. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about what you have going on in front of us.
Well, we'll start with the Isabel Mondavi Chardonnay. It is from Carneris. Rob is the interpreter winemaker. He interprets his mother's tastes and then makes wine to please her. So why don't we let Rob tell you about the wine?
Yeah. So we've got here pretty remarkable Chardonnay that we're jumping in on. And what I'm really liking about the Chardonnay is that Isabel, Mama, didn't want really what was just standard out in the marketplace, which is really the genesis of wanting to create her own wine. So what we've done is we've found a way to compact a good little bit of oak in there where it's not overbearing, and this round, lovely butteriness without it being heavy. So what I'd love to ask you to do is just go ahead and grab that bottle, the Isabel Mondavi Chardonnay, and pour some of that. That's our 2012 vintage. And I got to tell you what, this is what I call banging Chardonnay. It's perfect, bright, good acidity, a little bit of oak in there. So why don't I let you check that out, and you tell me what you're thinking.
Okay, I mean, the first thing I'm thinking is that, when we opened up our first restaurant, I worked with my mom a little bit, and she answered the phones. And, man, she would tell me when someone had two cups of coffee instead of one in the morning, she would tell me if something was out of place from the night before.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about what are some of the challenges working so closely with your family, and then maybe also what are some of the... And some of the things were really appreciated that she would say, and then some of the things were like, Mom, come on, I need to like get some work done, and it's not that important.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think the toughest challenge at first was that she was very, very kind the first few years because we made the Chardonnay for her. And she would say, yes, I like this blend. And then next year we'd come up to harvest and we'd ask her how it was, and she said, well, I kind of want to tinker with this a little bit. So I think that for our experience, that Mom was not specific enough to get what she wanted the first couple of years. And then we changed the fermentation methodology up just a little bit to do something a little avant-garde in the cellar. And then at that moment, she really fell in love with the wine. So I think the challenge, like you asked, what was the rub, was that she was worried about hurting feelings, and we wanted to make sure it was right for her. So I think maybe a little different, but also a good challenge.
Okay, so we have a pretty sophisticated group of listeners here. So if you tell us a little bit more about when you changed
You want some trade secrets.
Yeah, what happened when you changed the fermentation techniques?
Let's get down and dirty then. So we've got first and secondary fermentation, your primary and your secondary. So the first is the yeast converting the sugars into alcohol. The secondary is malolactic fermentation. That's what gets all, Chardonnay creamy, buttery, fat. So we put those two together. And what that did is when we do them at the same time is it stops the duration of time for malolactic fermentation. Normally it takes a few months. This we're compacting in and do it in like a week. So you notice the Chardonnay has a little bit of creaminess, and it's also crisp at the same time. It's kind of like a push-pull thing going. Mm-hmm. That's how we really push that in together.
That push-pull, I think of as balance. It's usually, when I hear that word balance, I think that, you have the acidity, but you also have some richness, and they're balancing each other out. So I imagine you do that by doing everything in stainless steel, temperature control, and controlling everything as much as possible, or how does that happen?
You know, it happens a little bit like a runaway, unbridled horse that you're just grabbing mane and trying to hang on to. So my good mentor, Tony Coltrane, came up with this fermentation strategy and put this into play because we just needed to fine-tune this a little bit. I would have never came up with that fermentation methodology. He nailed it. But it's all in barrel, beautiful little small French oak barrels for the Isabel Mondavi Chardonnay. And what we're doing is the primary and secondary going off at the same time in those small French oak barrels. And I think that's what makes the Isabel Mondavi Chardonnay unique and different.
Now, Michael, I'm going to turn to you. You've seen, and I should also say, I'm really enjoying this. I've had quite a few sips now, and truly, it is balanced, and you're not just saying that. But now you've seen California Chardonnay go through some ebbs and flows over the years. How do you feel like this fits into the spectrum of California Chardonnay, and what do you see as the future?
Well, first of all, the original Chardonnays that were made were really made in either large redwood or concrete tanks. They weren't made in stainless steel or in oak barrels. And then in the late 60s, 70s, we started getting into oak. And like anything, at first, we went too much. And a lot of the California Chardonnays had far too much oak. They weren't balanced. They were too buttery, too rich, too heavy. And they literally fought food at that time. I think now we've come back to where balance is extremely important. You want the flavor of the grape. You want a kiss of the oak. You want it interesting, but you want it to complement the enjoyment of food, not overpower it.
And why do you feel it's important to taste that kiss of the oak? Do you think that it's something that people have just so come to expect from Chardonnay that it has to be there or they're not going to like it?
I think it's different than that. I think it's like in cooking with a chef using certain herbs or spices or salt or pepper. It will add to the flavor of the dish. If you use too much, it overpowers it. I think for maybe 20 years, we in California were using too much oak. We're now learning how to ratchet it down, get beautiful balance, beautiful finish in the wine, so it invites you to have a second or third glass.
Yeah, I was thinking about it as salt with cooking. I know Dina and Robert Jr. are big cooks. Your father was telling me some other embarrassing stories as well. but I think about it as salt. Most dishes, if the salt's not there, you definitely know it. And if there's too much salt, you know it. But if it's in the right balance, it's just enhancing all the flavors. So when you have the right balance of oak, then it just brings everything together. Dina, I want to ask you: what are the kinds of wines that you find yourself drinking?
Oh, that's a hard question to answer. I'm in love with so many different types of wine. It's more about what am I eating at that moment? What kind of wine goes best with that? And usually what I do is I just go downstairs to my garage and pull a bottle and enjoy it with my dinner. I don't know. I'm a big Cabernet fan. I love Napa Valley Cabernets. I'm really proud of what my father has done with his M Cabernet of Napa Valley.
I'm definitely looking forward to trying that in a little bit, but I want to go back to this idea of cooking and wine pairing. For Robert Jr., your dad was just telling me a story about a special guest that you had over for dinner when you were a child.
Yeah, the remarkable story. So, Dad comes home on Thursday night and tells my mom that there's a chef who's going to be joining us for lunch on Saturday. And this particular chef was Julia Child and her husband. So you've got Dad delivering the news, and I'm, maybe 10, so that made it, it's cool. I've seen her cooking show, she's coming over. But my mom's a little panicked, right? You'd be panicked, right? George LeBlanc, Paul Bocuse, Bourdain's coming over to your house for dinner. I mean, that's pretty much what's happening. So my dad likes to say that he was a celibate priest for a while after, springing that, 48-hour notice that Julia Child's coming over for lunch. But yeah, absolutely. She comes over for lunch, and my mom serves burgers. burgers and a great potato salad and little, you know, a little butter lettuce, little gems. And Julia loved it because sometimes wine and food, it doesn't have to be ornate to be spectacular. And Julia Child, really, of anybody who appreciated wine and food together, truly she did. And she, I think, helped to pioneer that for us here in the United States to try to cook things and to try to enjoy. And the message that that my family took away from that was, you know, let's sit down, let's break bread together, do something simple, and enjoy the wine, the food, and the company. Because right then, you know, you had the master chef of all chefs at the time, and in my family, you know, no help to me, I'm 10 years old, right, who was one of the most renowned winemaking families. So to be able to relax a little bit and to just have a great burger and simple potato salad was a way to enjoy company together with the Robert Mondavi family and Julia Child.
Right, and sometimes if you try too hard, you just mess it up. There's no way that you're going to make a fancy dish that Julia can't do a little bit
really.
Better, at
it's
least.
It's like bringing sand to the beach, you know?
Jeez, yeah, that's what a crazy story. So so I keep going back to the Chardonnay. I'm enjoying it. Tell us a little bit about where this is from and Carneros. We really spoke quite a bit about the winemaking techniques, some of the barrel aging, fermentation at the same time. But what's unique about this this climate?
Well, yeah, you're talking really about where's the genesis of the wine. So you're talking about the vineyard sourcing right now. And the vineyard that we're using is coming from the estate. So this new winery of ours, which we purchased in 2006, the Michael Mondavi family estate, we call it now, the Isabel Mondavi Chardonnay has about just under half of the grape sourcing right on the property. That allows us right by the winery to harvest these grapes and within a few feet bring them right into the cellar and to start the crush and the fermentation. And then the other part is for the foodies who've been over into Sonoma County, right nestled up next to Napa Valley, is the Fremont Diner. And about a quarter mile away from the Fremont Diner is our second vineyard source on this, which is a beautiful hillside vineyard of Chardonnay. So that's nice and crisp. You asked a question, though. You asked, well, why is the climate different there? So we have this, the Golden Gate Bridge, everybody knows, and everyone knows San Francisco fog and, you know, and Samuel Clemens' lovely quote, the coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco. So why is that? It's because the Pacific Ocean's right there. Our water temperatures are about 52 degrees. So in comes this cold blast of air right through the San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge, and up San Pablo Bay into Napa. And there we are. We're in Carneros. We're like 5 miles away from the water. So you ask, why is the climate different there? Why is it good for Chardonnay? It's because it's cold and it's fresh and it's vibrant. So when you taste these wines and there's this beautiful, the Isabel Mondavi Chardonnay is showing the beautiful white peach and tart nectarine, that's why we're getting it, is because of exactly where we are.
And do you get a lot of fog influence in the morning? Does that happen and then it blows off?
My God, you're soaked in the morning. Yeah. Literally, the fog is so dense there in the mornings that you can turn your windshield wipers on when you're driving in, or you know, you get a little dew on your jacket as you're walking the vineyards in the morning, tasting the grapes for the Isabel Mondavi Chardonnay. It's a really great way to do it. You know, talk about moisturizing.
Wow, that's awesome. I'm tasting again, and that the oak is definitely there. But again, it's slight butteriness in the back, a little toastiness, but definitely a very, again, just a really balanced wine. I'm enjoying that quite a bit. Let's move on to another one. I'm excited to try something else.
So I think you're moving into the emblem Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon. That's exactly what Dad's pouring right there. Beautiful, just dark, inky. It's like this India ink color. It's just, you see this in the glass, and you know that there's going to be something just textured and rich there.
Mm-hmm. So what is the total production of all of your wines at this point?
Total production of these wines is I love to use some great analogies, is less than that of like an Arrowwood, which is a small boutique winery, substantially less than that of Opus One. So, you know, we're talking really small lot productions. And you know, as the folks tuning in on this should know, that with the Isabel Mondavi and the Michael Mondavi family estate wines, we have three different brands, if you will, three different marks. The Isabel Mondavi Chardonnay, because my mom has a different style and signature. And then Emblem, which is more of a reflection of my sister and I, and then my father has M. But all together, they're just this teeny little production of wine. And we have a signature that we each like and different styles of wine we like. So we try to keep it very succinct like that.
Mm-hmm. So, Michael, tell us a little bit about that, going from working in very, very large scale to something that's a little bit more small scale and boutique.
Well, it was really kind of full circle, because when we started in 1966 with my father, myself, and one other person, only three employees, if you wanted anything done, you had to do it yourself. And we then grew over the years to a very large winery at Robert Mondavi. And when we then reinvented ourselves in 2004 and created our new wines, it was like back to the future. It was neat because I could spend time in the vineyards, I could spend time in the cellars, and mainly I could spend time with my son and daughter doing what I love best, and that is making the wines and being involved in the actual winemaking. When you get a large company, all of a sudden you're involved in managing a lot of people, working with accountants, attorneys, and that was not my cup of tea. And it's really fun and wonderful to get back to the foundation, get back to the source, to the vineyards, and to the wines and the family.
You know, it's really interesting. So Mike Mondavi was the winemaker over at Robert Mondavi Winery from 66 to 74. And that's a pretty remarkable time in the wine industry, a time especially in California of discovery, of experimentation. So, you know, really, you know, it's not ever really talked a lot about because it just, our company shifted in 74 when he went to go and head up the sales and marketing side. But what I love is that I really look at him as the unsung hero of the winemaking back then, because he was involved with the wines that put not only the Robert Mondavi Winery on the map, but Napa Valley on the map. So to me, that's a great little unsung story of where his involvement was with the handling and the ferments of the wine back then.
Absolutely. Now, the story that people are telling here in New York, and I really do want to hear your opinion if you think this is an accurate story or if it's, you know, if it's inaccurate in any way, is that in California now people are moving back towards the way they were made at that time in the early 70s, mid-70s, where you have smaller estates who are making more balanced wines, who are not manipulating the wines as much as they were. Do you feel that is an accurate assessment, or is that just a handful of small wineries that people here in New York are getting excited about?
No, I think that's very accurate, in the fact that in the 60s, as we were starting to understand how to make great wines in Napa and California, as we grew, we then got more mass production, more scientific, more technological. And during that process, when we learned enough about the science and technology, we then went back to the soil and the climate. You make the wine in the vineyard. It's the flavor of grape that gives you the flavor in the wine. So we went from winemaking in the 70s and 80s back to wine growing now. And you need to be involved with each vineyard. They say the best fertilizer for a vineyard are the shoes of the owner of the winery. And if you walk through your vineyard, if you live in your vineyard, you can make great wines.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that as well, you know, in terms of restaurants, because I work in restaurants, and I think that the best kind of management is walking around, is mm-hmm. being around, being there and talking to people, as opposed to, you know, telling people what to do or sending things out. As long if you're there, if you're present, then people are going to act in a different way.
Memos and directives don't make great wine or great food.
So what that's a good point. And that's kind of leading into something that I was thinking about. Like, what are some things that you have learned from your time at a large scale winery that you think would be applicable to a smaller boutique firm?
Well, first of all, in today's world, we have whether it's the internet or other technology that helps us as a small winery to be technologically right up to speed with the large companies. You don't have to be a large winery to understand the science of winemaking, to have the laboratory equipment to run the proper proactive analysis, just like with a human, you give the human a physical, and you can say, gee, from the blood analysis, you're a little high in cholesterol, therefore you better change your diet. We can really predict the health of the wines through that science. Then it all comes to the smell, the taste, the sanitation, and the care you take with the barrels in the cellar.
All right. Well, I'm gonna want to talk a little bit about the care you take with this emblem because I've been enjoying it. And also I'm going to want to talk to Dina a little bit about what it's like to grow up in a winemaking family. It's always been a dream of mine to be born into a great Barolo family, but clearly that didn't happen. So we're going to take a quick...
Barolo. How about a Napa Valley family? I'm sitting right here with
I'll
you.
Take that as well. But we'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back on In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Inventory by Tom Cruise on heritageradionetwork.org. Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
And we're back on In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm here with Michael, Dina, and Robert Mondavi Jr. And we all have in our glasses the Michael Mondavi Family Winery Emblem, Cabernet Sauvignon, Napa Valley, 2010. I'm enjoying it quite a bit, actually. So when you started the Michael Mondavi Winery and went out to make another Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon, there are so many out there. What did you think you had to add to the conversation?
Well, first of all, we started with the emblem single vineyard hillside called Oso Vineyard because we wanted to have a foundation. Nobody needs another Cabernet. What you need is another Cabernet that's going to wow you, and you go, wow, that is really something. We started that 5 years ago. The emblem 2010 Napa Valley, this is the premier vintage, and Rob and Dina wanted to create something that was a combination of the hillside with the valley floor, and I'll let the two of them describe the style of the wines.
Well, the emblem is quite a fun wine for Rob and I to make. It's coming off of quite a couple of vineyards of ours, and it's showing a new expression that Rob and I really enjoy. It's, I think, a fruit forward. It's a really friendly wine. I have trouble pacing myself with this wine. I like it so much. It's pretty new for us, but it's been opened a few times at home already.
So this is why your husband, Darren, keeps asking me for more wine, more of the emblem map of Al. I get it now.
Yeah. Well, I'm enjoying it very much. It is not, it certainly has Napa Valley ripeness, but without being overripe, which is one thing that I sometimes don't like about Napa Valley wines.
Overripe is a very good word, and I agree with you completely on not liking it. The wine becomes more port-like and heavy. Wine is supposed to cleanse the palate, excite the taste buds, and invite you to have another bite of your food or another sip of the wine. And with that, you need beautifully balanced flavor and a nice finish, not an overpowering heavy wine. And I think that Rob and Dina have come up with a great blend of this, and it's not 100% Cabernet. In fact, Rob has this love affair with Syrah, and he has brought Syrah and Petite Syrah into the blend to really add complexity to it.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about Petite Sirah on the blend, because that's a grape that I think a lot of us are not as familiar with.
Yeah, Petite Sirah is pretty remarkable. So, yeah, you know, I affectionately refer to Cabernet Sauvignon as my desert island wine. Taking it there, not even a question. That's my end-all, be-all wine. But this damn Petite Sirah is like these sirens that are just calling to me. You know, tie me to the mast so I don't get off course kind of thing. And it's remarkable. So Petite Sirah, you know, you said you got some wine guys and gals listening, so I'm going to go with it. So Petite Sirah is a hybrid, if you will, of Pellicerin, and it was crossed with Syrah by a guy named Darif. And so the grape over in Europe is called Darif. We call it Petite Sirah for whatever reason over here. And it's dark, it's inky, it's brooding, it's a little angry during fermentation, but after it's tamed, it becomes this beautiful violet aromatics and blueberries in the palate. For a blender, Petite Sirah is exceptional because it adds backbone and body. It adds these boysenberry fruit profiles to the wine, which are familiar, right? These characteristics are familiar for all of the people who love wine. But they're just a little bit different to where you're putting your nose in the glass and saying, my God, it's Cabernet, but there's a little something, you know, outside the box here. And that's what I love about this. I didn't want to make another Cabernet Sauvignon. Great. There's Cabernet Sauvignons out there. I wanted to make a modern interpretation of this where we're using a little bit of Petite Sirah, a little bit of Petite Verdot. We have actually a little Zin, a little old vine Zin. So it's just this beautiful blend to coax out different flavors. So it's familiar and a little bit alluring because you just aren't sure what's going on.
Well, just to go through the how you conceptualize a wine like that and what are some of the decisions that you make when coming through the blend, was the Petite Sirah something that had already been existing and you knew about a block of it and then purchased it to add to the blend? Or is it something that you'd planted intentionally because you said, I want this flavor in this wine?
I planted it over at our Oso Ranch because I love it. You know, that's kind of hard stop right there. I planted Petite Sirah because I love it. I wanted to make a single vineyard wine out of it, which we did. And then when the family got together and we were talking about the creation of the emblem Napa Valley, which we're tasting here right now, we said we need to do something different. We need to have a signature to this wine. It can't just be another Napa Valley Cabernet. So when we made the emblem Napa Valley, we decided that we wanted to blend in a little bit of this Petite Sirah to really increase the sex appeal, a little bit of the spiciness and the edginess of the wine.
All right, and turning over to Dina, I don't know if you had a chance to think about my question before. So it's like I said, it's always been this like crazy fantasy of mine that obviously it's never going to happen, that I was born into a family that that makes great wines, that lives in wine country. Is that always a dream? Is there sometimes is it sometimes a nightmare? Or how do you feel about this?
Growing up, Mondavi was. Well, my only life I've had, so I have nothing to compare it to, but there were a lot of great perks. You know, I was at the launch of Luce in 97 in Italy, and I met Gianni Versace. You know, I think the downside about working in a family business is when you call in sick, everyone calls you and wants to bring you soup when you just wanted a day off. So you really don't get the call in sick like you do at other companies. But it's been such a blessing to be part of this family. My favorite thing to do is to come to work and to blend with my brother and my father. It's the best thing in the world.
Did you know you were going to be in wine the whole time? Was there ever an option? If you said
there was always an option. I think one of my first memories is, you know, you don't have to work for the family. We want you to do what you want to do. And in fact, it was important for my brother and I to work outside of the family before we came to the family. That was the one condition to work for the family, is we had to work outside.
Okay, and that gave you a basis and said, all right, if I found something else I love. For some reason, the beautiful rolling hills in Napa Valley drew you back. I can't imagine why.
Not quite. Actually, I'm the only Mondavi living outside of Napa.
Okay. Where do you live?
I live in San Francisco. I love it.
Okay. Fantastic. Yeah. Okay. So now we have in our glass a new wine, a little bit deeper in color, a little bit darker. What did you pour for us here?
This is the M by Michael Mondavi, and this is it's really my flagship. I found the land for this in the mid-90s, planted the late 90s, and it's in a hillside up at around 1,200 feet elevation in Atlas Peak. Not much soil, just volcanic rock. what I'd learned over the last 40 years in the wine business was that the greatest wines from Napa are going to come from the hillsides. The valley floor has beautiful Cabernets, but the greatest wines are going to be hillside with the structure and the smaller berries, richer flavor. This wine is 100% Cabernet, 100% from our Animo vineyard. And Animo, Dina, why don't you tell us about Animo? Where'd the name come from?
This was after my second year of Italian in a university, and I learned the word Animo. It means soul or spirit in Italian. And being an Italian family and not very French, I decided to use Animo as our word for terroir. So it's kind of the total spirit and sense of place. So this is the Animo vineyard. When you come to this vineyard, it's probably one of the most beautiful vineyards I've ever seen. It's gorgeous. Beautiful hills. We have a canyon right in front of us, and Rob tells a story of, you know, you take a stone and you throw it off the side, you won't hear that stone hit either the side or the bottom of the canyon for a good 3 to 5 seconds. So this is quite an amazing place. We have great winds that come up every afternoon. Rob and my dad have made this vineyard such an incredible vineyard. They've worked on it in terms of soil, leafing, exposure, everything. And so it's quite a great vineyard. I love it.
The key is the grapes are the flavor of the wine. You don't make the wine in the cellar. So we have the pleasure of Rob, Tony Coltrane, a winemaker I've had the luxury of working with for 36 years as well, and myself walking the vineyard, tasting the grapes, and we determine through flavor of the grapes in the vineyard when to harvest. Not just sugar and acid and pH and analytics. It's 100% the flavor in the mouth that morning.
Yeah, judging from the color, I would guess even more fruit, even more ripe. There certainly is more concentration, but in this one, as opposed to the emblem, I notice more floral notes and more of a rockiness to it. And then, yes, certainly a concentration of fruit. So that's really pretty. So congratulations on that one.
It's Thank you. Yeah, it's more of a classic global type wine, like a Bordeaux, whereas the emblem is more of the California style, the more avant-garde.
Mm-hmm. You know, you look at this wine in the glass, the M by Michael Mondavi, and this is the 1999 vintage that we're drinking right now. And I hate correcting Dad. The only thing I'll say on this is that there's actually 4% Petit Verdot in this blend, and the Petit Verdot adds a little bit of the floral attribute and a little bit of the femininity to the aromatics of the wine. It's really pretty. You can just put a little drop behind your ears. It's like a great perfume. It's just beautiful. So this wine, the importance of this is worth noting. So of all the vineyards that Michael's seen in his life, he bought one vineyard for his personal enjoyment, and that was this vineyard in the 90s. He's made one wine that has his name and his name only as a representation of the wine, and that is this wine. So think about this guy who pioneered the California wine industry, who helped put Napa Valley on the map, who then finds the one vineyard in Napa or around the world that he thinks is remarkable, and then he creates that one wine from it. The intensity of this wine, the amount of detail that we put into this wine is unlike any other. It really is. It's like finding that time in life when you have the jumping off point to create your masterpiece. And this 2009 M by Michael Mondavi is something that's just absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, it is truly, truly a beautiful wine. And I think classic in the way that that I would hope and imagine other classic Napa Valley Cabernets to be. But unfortunately, we have to wrap things up. I feel like I could ask you guys questions for another half hour or hours. So I might just have to come knock on your door.
Roll tape segment 2.
I wish we could do the John Stewart. Do you have some time? We can put this up on the web. But unfortunately, we can't do that. But thank you so much for stopping by. I know this isn't Napa Valley out in Bushwick, but we enjoy having you here nonetheless.
Well, come and visit us in Napa, and we'll record in the vineyard.
Sounds great. And thanks to all of you to listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.